Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Welcome to Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, the podcast for people who like to listen to things. Things that Tom says, things that Tom's guests have to say. It's the podcast that gives and gives and gives and doesn't expect anything in return. Okay, that's not really true, but it's free. Anyway, here's Tom.
Well, thanks so much, everybody, for downloading the podcast. Yes, it's Big Pop Fun, and I'm Tom Wilson, the host with not the, I don't have the most, but the host with some. Thanks so much. It's welcome. Welcome. If you've been here before, welcome back. Welcome back to another magical sleigh ride. Yes, of enchantment and wonder as we begin to think about the start of school. And we begin to see the displays of pens and mechanical pencils, spiral notebooks, and we look at each other and it dawns on us. And we scream in anguish and we try to turn the magical sleigh around so we don't have to face the fact that life still happens. We have to go to school. But hey, that's life. So the sleigh is heading towards September and school, and that's just the way it is. Boy, man, I don't think anyone wore a wider black armband than I did in September. Yeah, it just wasn't my thing. But good luck to all of you. Good luck to all of you teachers. Good luck to you parents. Good luck to you people who are studying. And go have at it, kids. Good for you. I think it's very useful because I've used every bit of that math that I struggled and failed through. Now, you know, my inclination was right in 10th grade. You know, when I looked down at the paper of a math test and I said, you can hire people to do this for you. And it turns out I was right. The podcast is brought to you by my book, The Masked Man. It's available in the iTunes store for the iPad. It's available on Kindle. It's available on Nook. It's available in every way. People are liking the book, and I appreciate that very much. I mean, people who get the thing. I enjoy writing things that are for – I'm not writing for an audience specifically, but I like going out on a limb and doing something that a lot of people aren't going to understand. So I don't think that my book is for everybody. And years ago, I did a one-man show called Cowboy Tommy, which was an interesting kind of a Wild West show that happened within the confines of a small theater. And I was alone. And the first night, I was very upset. The first night that I previewed it and was just working on these concepts, and it was in very rough shape, and the audience knew that it was in very rough shape, and at least a third, if not half, probably half of the audience walked out on the show. And at the end of the show, I was, I must tell you, I was very upset. Within the next couple of nights, from the people who have stayed, they brought back like six people to say, I don't know what it is, but you've got to see this thing. And it had become a success in a niche market, I suppose, but it had become a success. And that warmed my heart a lot that it wasn't for everybody. And this podcast isn't for everybody. And my book isn't for everybody. But for the people who find it, who it's for, it strikes a chord, and I just appreciate that very much, very much. And also, I always say, hey, support artists where you are. As I've said in the previous podcast, not necessarily by sending them your money so that they can finish a project. Why not just buy a ticket to the project? Why not just, but hey, if they have the finished thing, buy it. If they've made a painting and you can afford it and you like it and it's something where it brings something to life inside of you, buy it. I'm not talking about Kickstarter anymore. I'm not. If everyone wants to, you know, support whims, do it. Emilio Palami is my guest. And Emilio, many years ago, I was singing and playing the guitar at church, as I did from the time that I was a teenager. I was in, you know, whatever, quote unquote, youth group. I did all of those things, and I played the guitar, and I sang, and I had big bell-bottomed blue jeans, and I had, you know, we just wanted to embroider everything, embroider a denim shirt, embroider a guitar strap. I think for a while there, I had a velour-embroidered guitar strap in the late 70s, and that was really cool, man. So I sang I sang and played at church for many, many years. And many years ago, a wonderful musician, I've never been a great musician. I've always been the musician. I'm the Rudy of music. I'm just on the sidelines, ready, with my mouth guard in, saying, send me in, coach, send me in, send me in. I've never been that talented a musician, because here's my instinct with music. As a very severe asthmatic, when I was very young, in the sixth grade, I decided that I wanted to play the tuba. Yes, an asthmatic tuba player. Yes, that's yeah, so my instinct was off with that, because I was a good tuba player, but never a great one. I think I'm a good guitarist, but not a great one. But I came to L.A. and I began studying the tuba with Jim Self, one of the leading studio musicians in Los Angeles. And because I always wanted to, I just wanted to get better on the horn. I thought I never gave it my best shot, or I didn't. Something was wrong. I didn't quite have the tuba in my back pocket. I was good, but not great. And I played for him on our first lesson, and he said, "Of course," he said, "Tom, you just don't use nearly enough air." And I know the odds were against me as far as tuba went, and I played it, I enjoyed it, and then it was time to put it aside. But I've always so admired great musicians, that facility, that virtuosity on the instrument that just makes it look easy. And of course, you know that it's easy because the people have lived at that instrument for years and years of their life. And Emilio Palami came up to me at church after singing a few songs that I had written so many years ago and said, "Boy, I really enjoyed those. Who wrote those songs?" I wrote the songs. And he invited me to his studio where we recorded the songs, and I made an album. I made a CD of it. I made cassette tapes of it. That's how far back we're talking. There were wonderful cassette tapes that I still have, many boxes. If anyone would like some cassette tapes, I've got them, of In the Name of the Father, Tom Wilson's first musical recording. But Emilio Palami was the producer of that, and just a magnificent musician, orchestrator, arranger. And Emilio has worked in the entertainment industry for his entire adult life as an arranger and producer and a pianist par excellence. So I thought it would be interesting to talk to another musician, and a musician of great skill. And I hope you enjoy my conversation with my old buddy, Emilio Palami.
It's Big Pop Fun.
Fan of the Buffalo Bills. I know that.
Okay, you had to bring that up right away.
Because we talk Buffalo Bills because you are from Buffalo.
Yes, I am.
But you've been here a long time in California.
Yes, since 1978.
What did your dad do in Buffalo?
My dad was an electronics engineer. He worked for the Sylvania Corporation.
Did he?
Yeah, and originally, actually, before that, it was very interesting. He worked for American Machine and Foundry, which AMF, which we know from the bowling.
Bowling, yeah. Right.
Well, he actually was the draftsman who worked on the first design of the first automatic pin spotter. And I actually still have those plans tucked away in a closet at home.
And you always, and the wife says, hey, we got to eBay those plans.
Yeah, right.
For the pin spotter.
Yeah, perfect.
Is that what they call it, a pin spotter?
Like the automatic pin spotter. Yeah, because it was during the transition when they actually had pin boys that would put the pins down and line them up, and then you had to wait for him to, like, let them up, and then they came up with the automatic machine that, you know, that raked them back in and threw them up into this.
Counted them, put the lights on of what you what you have remaining to hit and everything.
Big revolution in America.
So that was called American Machine and Foundry.
Yes.
What did they do before bowling? Did they do it? Was it like a foundry?
A lot of machine parts for the military, for the defense. They made weapons. They made. I think it was mostly forging a lot of parts that were parts of other things. So they were doing defense contracts, but during this period, I'm remiss to know the date, but. My dad worked on that, and that's kind of his little claim to fame.
And was he, I mean, a name like Palame, was he Italian? Was he born here? Was he born in Buffalo?
He was born in Buffalo. His parents on both sides were from Sicily.
Oh, okay.
And actually the derivation of the name Palame comes from the city of Palermo. My grandfather, Salvatore, and my other grandfather, Cirincione, their original families were from a small town called Ravenusa in Sicily. But my dad traced it back in the name.
Ravenusa in Sicily, that's where the mafia collects, right?
I think so.
Ravenusa. We need a little Ravenusa. Hey, yeah. Palami, get over here.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
But my dad traced it back, and actually my ancestry comes from Greece, and the original name was Palamides. And then they traveled to Sicily, went to Palermo, became Palame, and here I am.
Wow. Did you cry at your first few piano lessons?
I did.
Did you really?
I cried with joy because I was one of those kids who begged my parents for a piano.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, you didn't? So you didn't have a piano. How old were you?
It was probably 7 years. I was kind of a late starter. I didn't really start taking lessons until about 11.
Who had a piano at their house that you said, that's so cool, Ricky has a piano?
It was the Dybel family that was right down the street from where I live. They had an old upright piano in their garage.
Oh, in the garage?
Yes.
Who played it that you saw?
No one. No one
but
played it.
But you saw, like, the vision of it was cool?
When I touched those keys, it hit something with me, and I begged my parents to get me a piano. I said, I really want to play piano.
And Dad went out and bought an upright?
They found actually a console piano. It was in Iverson Pond, which still exists in Buffalo at my cousin Michael's house, the Geraci family. That's on my father's sister's side.
So the piano comes in, and you started taking lessons, and you were just like a duck to water?
Yes, I was. I had a really great piano teacher. My first piano teacher, my first piano teacher was a Polish man named Ed Fischer, who was an accordionist who taught piano.
Well, there's a keyboard of sorts on the accordion itself.
Absolutely.
So you have to be something of a keyboard player to play the accordion.
Yeah, he was interesting. He played a lot of social gigs around town and stuff. He was like one of those guys. And I took from him for a few months, I think. And
but the first five pieces that you learned were all variations of Lady of Spain.
Exactly. Yes, the old stomach Steinway.
Yeah, did he teach you things that he knew, or you started in a little program or a little book?
Started with the Alfred Duberger piano course. I still have the book.
Are you really? The Alfred Duberger?
Yes.
So it sounded classy, to people.
Yes, it did. Yes.
Our son Emilio, he's studying the Alfred Duberger piano method.
That's right. My first big piece was Goodbye, Old Paint, because the left hand went...
Oh, sure, the cowboy song.
There you go.
Were you good right away?
I think I was good when I didn't have to read music. I like just making
stuff. So you noodled at it, and you like that.
And what was actually my inspiration is that my parents found a piano teacher named Anthony Mano, just a blessed human being, very, very soft-spoken, sort of reminded me of Rudd Skelton in a way. He had this just sort of funny, charismatic demeanor. And the thing he would do is at the end of every lesson, he'd say, now I'm going to play a new piece for you that I just learned. It's Chopin. But it wasn't Chopin. He would sit down and he would improvise in the style of Chopin. And I said, that's what I want to be able to do. I want to make stuff up and make it happen.
Because to you, it seemed cooler to just improvise Chopin sounding things
that's right.
than to play Chopin.
Exactly.
Isn't it funny? Yeah. Because there's people who listen to the podcast, Jonathan May, who's a friend of mine, who's also a composer, and he plays ragtime and honky-tonk stuff at Disneyland.
Wow.
Because he studied classically for about 10 years, and he's doing all the things, and he's playing Chopin, and he goes to Disneyland. That's and there's a guy with the bowler hat and everything playing.
I love those guys,
and he
man.
Just saw that and thought, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen. And the man says, well, you know, I give lessons. You know, I'll come to your house. And forget it. Chopin?
Yeah.
Schmopan.
Yeah, right.
I don't care anymore. I'm playing that fun stuff.
And it was on.
And it was on. And it was on. And he still does. A wonderful, wonderful musician. But did you play all through school? I mean, you just kind of developed and got better and better? Or was there, like, did you read music early on? Or were you always fooling around so much?
My thing was I did learn how to read music, but not to the level that a lot of people did that were really studying heavily classical, because that really wasn't my interest. Classical music wasn't my interest. I liked popular tunes. I wanted to be able to play popular music. And what really kind of made it all come together is we started a rock band when I was in sixth grade.
Sixth grade, wow.
Yeah. And I actually started off as the lead singer in the band, not playing piano, but my aunt, who lived next door to us, had an organ. She had a Baldwin organ that had a Leslie in it. And so I started playing organ.
Explain to people who don't know what a Leslie is, you have an organ.
Okay,
with a Leslie.
A Leslie is a classic sound that organ. It's an amplifier setup that has a rotating speaker. So when the sound goes through it, it swirls the sound, and it can go at two different speeds, the chorale speed, which is a slow sort of dreamy kind of sound, and then a fast sound, which sort of sounds almost like a fast vibrato, and it gives excitement. And you can add more expression to what you play by turning it on and off, slowing it up, speeding down. You'll hear that when you listen to organ solos.
Sure, those historic organs, especially of rock and roll, and when they came into rock and roll, exactly.
Yeah.
And they were used very, very, and still are. They're probably very expensive now to find one.
Absolutely.
Or they get electronics to kind of try to replicate the sound.
Yes, there's several.
So you were, what kind of stuff were you playing in the sixth grade rock band?
Well, we played everything from the Monkees to because I was playing keyboards, we played the Doors. So I learned the
that's organ stuff.
Yeah, and it was
Light My Fire.
Light My Fire was the big one, and then Set Me Free by who had the big hit? Vanilla Fudge.
Uh huh.
And that's
I would think Light My Fire on the organ wouldn't be too. It's gonna.
Well, you know,
yeah. Oh, sure.
That's was like the big thing. So,
were you guys popular at school? Did everyone know you had a band?
We played at the YMCA dances. We actually had gigs. We played at the Y. And the funny thing was that my Aunt Carol's work, because we rehearsed down in her basement, and there were 15 stairs to get upstairs, and we five guys
took the organ to gigs
up the stairs.
Sixth graders.
With the help of the uncles and brothers, and you know, we took it, and then we rented a small truck, a van, and put it in there and took it over and played.
And were you in bands through high school?
Yes, I was.
Well, did you do anything else, or were you by that time? You know, when did it start occurring to you that I'm pretty good at this, and this is kind of working out, this music thing?
I think whether it was working out or not, it was my passion and it was what I wanted to do.
And that was from the beginning?
From the beginning. It hit me. I'm actually in the process of writing a book about of this right now.
Because I saw a documentary with Jeff Lynne, who worked with so many people, a producer of everything. I mean, from the Beatles to Electric Light Orchestra and all the Traveling Wilburys. And it was like he did his first gig. And his mom woke him up from school the next day. And he says, never wake me up again. I'm a professional musician.
Well, I had that vision. The whole idea of what music did both in my heart and in my brain really just hit me really hard. And I just loved it so much. I couldn't get enough.
What did it do in your heart as a kid?
It allowed me to it's an interesting thing. I think I became a musician because to escape the angst of my very loud Sicilian family.
So it was just a lot of yelling.
There was a lot of angst, especially, you know, you've seen Silver Linings Playbook.
Uh-huh.
The relationship between De Niro and Bradley Cooper was like what it was between my dad and my brother. I mean, there was some serious tension. And I went down in the basement after my parents got me the piano, and I just went down there and just went dreamy land because I just didn't want to know about it.
Huh.
It was an escape for me. I think wanting to work in the arts, both as a musician and as an actor, it's kind of an escape to, like, just stress,
mm-hmm.
life in general, like all of the stuff that.
So when you were in high school, what was your band's name?
The Magical Staircase.
The Magical Staircase. Cool. And what's you were just playing rock and you were cover bands.
We were totally cover band. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We played a little bit of Beatles, we played a little bit of Rolling Stones, which that was the stuff that I was doing when I was just a lead singer. Then when I started playing organ, we started doing the songs that fit more. And we actually even went into some R&B. We did a little Sam and Dave. The Rascals were big.
At that time, were you reading music? Or
no,
were you just like,
not.
Okay, Sam and Dave, let me hear it on the radio. Let me buy the 45,
and
I'll figure this out on the keyboard.
Absolutely.
So everything was in the key from the record because that's the way you had to play
along
with it.
That was the only thing you knew.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no transposition.
Wow.
It was what it was.
Were you getting good gigs at the end of high school?
You know, it started to change because that band sort of dissolved, and then I started working with another friend of mine and a couple other friends of mine, and we started a band called Summer Voyage, and we played at the nightclubs around Buffalo, and that was more of like playing everything from like Burt Bacharach tunes, but done our way.
Uh-huh.
The Stylistics doing a little bit of R&B, some cool jazz stuff like Quincy Jones arrangements from Smatwater Jack and stuff like that.
Uh-huh. Wow. So when you graduated from high school, by that time, when did you decide, this is what I'm doing? This is it. I'm done. Bands and things and music from so early.
Yeah, really early. From sixth grade on, I knew I wanted to be a musician. And in the midst of all of that, I was always wanted to act too. There was the school plays and the school musicals and little dramas and stuff. So somewhere in the midst of all of that, the performance part of me and the wanting to get that connection with people, whether it be through music or through being on the stage, I just lived there. I don't know.
Yeah,
it felt great to me. It felt to get. I love that response. You know, the feeling that you get. You know what it is.
I haven't experienced it yet, but I mean that the approval and the thing.
Yeah.
But I keep working at it.
That's what we love about you.
Stay hungry. Out of high school, what did you do? Just went off and did gigs?
No. This was an interesting thing because I knew I wanted to study music formally because I didn't feel like I really knew like the written side of music.
You had a nice house, but you hadn't really built a foundation for it.
Exactly.
So a storm could come.
Exactly. So, and I really wanted to get that together. So I decided in my senior year to get enough classical tunes together. I learned a Bach invention or a Prelude and Fugue, a piece by Debussy, and a Chopin Nocturne. And so I could audition for Fredonia State University. And so I auditioned and I got put on the waiting list. Because I didn't have the musical skills formally that these kids who – because I went to a Catholic high school, and we had no music program whatsoever at our school. The only thing we had was the musical that we did every year that I was in, and I had actually started a jazz choir while I was in school, and I played at all of the school masses playing piano with acoustic guitar.
Really?
Yes.
And it was a jazz choir specifically?
Yes.
Because I would think for a person without a lot of – kind of the theory underneath it, that was a lot of listening. I mean, like Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, for those sophisticated voicings of chords, if you're really doing a jazz kind of choir, huh?
Yeah, my thing was is I took Hill Where the Lord Hides, written by Chuck Mangione, and I could play that tune, and so I divided up all the parts of the orchestra for the people in the choir to sing.
Oh, so they were doing that?
Yeah.
It was kind of like a scat choir.
Yeah, it was really neat. Everybody really liked it. We performed at the school and stuff. It was pretty sweet.
Nice.
Actually.
So was it difficult to really start building the foundation and start saying, this is how you read music? This is going back to goodbye old paint.
Yeah, it really went right back to the roots. I mean, I got into, you know, I studied enough and worked at those pieces, got them off the page. Because once I could get something off the I think that was part of the reason why I didn't like reading music, because I didn't want to be looking at something. I wanted to be feeling it and playing it. And so I would learn the stuff and get it off the pages. I mean, I could read music well enough and understand how rhythmic notation worked. But I just was never a sight reader, you know, like one of those kids who could, like, you put a piece of music in front of them, they go, I'll get out of here.
But for a lot of that, for pieces that the things that were interesting to you,
yes,
are very syncopated kind of melodies,
yes,
very syncopated music, which is difficult to read on a page,
yes,
what the feeling they're trying to get across and how the beats happen, not just that there are beats, but how the mm-hmm. beats happen in the song. And I think that's true of a lot of people and a lot of excellent performers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could see it on the page, but they want to get, what is the feel of this thing?
Yeah, and that's where I've always been. I've been kind of the feel guy. Like, I get it into my soul and then get it into my fingers. Get it uh-huh. off the page, get it into my heart and soul, get it to my fingers, and then release it to the world.
Yeah. Now, before we move on with your life, how was your brother? Did he get through high school?
Yes.
Did he survive? What was his interest?
My brother was in a sports guy. He was He was the pitcher, the football player, and then he went into the Marine Corps.
Whoa, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So
he's done okay.
He's done fine.
And he's a tough guy.
He's a tough guy.
And is he still in Buffalo?
No, he actually lives out here. We moved out here together, actually, when we came out to California.
Oh.
Yeah. And we shared a house for a while, and now he moved to Santa Barbara, and now he lives in Camarillo. Not in the institution.
And Camarillo is a large city.
Yeah. It's a lot of people associated.
Yeah. So then you got out of school. Were you gigging while you were in school? Were you doing... Did you have a band?
Oh, absolutely, yes. All through high school and college.
College,
playing on the weekends. The biggest thing in college was I got to be part of the jazz ensemble program at Fredonia State University after I got in. You know, skipping back to the little part of the story, at my audition, I said, you know I don't play like a lot of these kids who've been studying classical music since they were three. I said, but I know that music is all I want to do. So if you let me into this university... I'll really do. And so I didn't know I was going to Fredonia State University until the end of May of my senior year.
And you were, there are a lot of jerks in educational institutions, but if you heard a kid say that, wouldn't you let him in?
Absolutely.
I totally would.
Yeah, and I think it must have worked. And I actually had a scholarship from my grades, a Regents scholarship through the state of New York, so I was able to go to school on a scholarship, but it wasn't for music. It was just as a student, but I took music as a major and I was accepted and... Went to school 5 years there, actually. I got my degree in music in theory and composition and in education. I got a dual degree. And then was offered an assistantship to teach jazz arranging and improvisation and music theory for minors as a graduate assistant.
That's quite a journey over 4 or 5 years.
Yes.
From saying, I would like to come here to learn the the principles behind the thing that I do, mm-hmm. to only a few years later saying, we'd like you to teach this, the fundamentals of the infrastructure of what you've been learning here.
I spent a great deal of time, you know, studying, practicing, you know. I was fully immersed, and there was really nothing better for me than to be away at school, because that's all I did. You know, I wasn't a partier. I wasn't, you know. In fact, I ended up running the jazz ensemble program at Fredonia State University for several years, and they used to call me hard ass because I didn't go out, hang out, party. I was like always writing out an arrangement. I was learning the trombone voicings from a Thad Jones or a Count Basie tune, and just immersed in figuring out what it was and loving it. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I loved the journey. I loved all during that. I have great memories of during that time in college because I was just totally immersed.
And when did you publish, you know, the music? You had a system, didn't you? Some kind of musical system, Emil Palame, something.
Well, I had a whole series. I had a whole series of band arrangements.
Band arrangements.
Yeah, that I did for that were.
Were those from standards that you would arrange for jazz ensemble?
There were some that were tunes that were standard tunes, and some of them were my original. So I had a series that was published of both.
So even very early on, you were writing mm-hmm. like big arrangements,
yes.
original arrangements,
yes.
for jazz ensemble. So
yes.
you're writing. What would it be? It would be four trombones. It would be four trumpets. It would be four saxes.
Five saxes,
mm-hmm. including baritone sax.
That's right.
Did you write any music for tuba?
I'm sorry.
Get out of my house.
I'm sorry, Tom.
Get out of my house. That's my big – okay, for music nerds out there, it's my big beef that they will give all of these all of the bass voicings to the, quote, bass trombone.
Yes.
Which actually doesn't play really in a bass register.
Not like a tuba.
Not like a tuba, no. Which gives it everything a bottom, especially in a horn section.
That's right.
But the tuba is largely – ignored,
yes,
in the jazz repertoire.
And I am remiss that it, but there were a couple of arrangements that we did that Thad Jones had done for an extended studio big band where there were four French horns and a tuba, and we did play some of those, and so I got to get some
okay,
credit.
I give you a reprieve.
Thank you so much.
Just
man.
This once. Okay. But I hear so many jazz bands, and they've got two trombonists playing with this trombone at the worst timbre
right.
of the trombone and sound. And I say, well, why not get one tuba player, replace the two trombonists, and you've got a bottom for this whole thing going through.
Absolutely. It's,
anyway.
I think you should start like a movement.
Never mind. Okay. Lots of people have tried.
Okay.
Lots of people have tried. Have you heard the band Heavy Tuba?
I have not.
You have not heard the piece Zarathustra's Revenge?
Oh, wow.
Which, anyway, it's the theme to 2001 A Space Odyssey, all tubas.
You know, on
check
that note, though, I did get a chance to do a recital when I was at Fredonia State University. At Fredonia State with Harvey Phillips.
Harvey tubas. Phillips was a friend of mine. Emilio. Harvey Phillips was a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Boy, he could play.
Who was from the Midwest. He was probably the greatest tuba player of all time.
And I had the pleasure of playing just a duo recital with him at Fredonia State. We did about six or seven jazz standards and played together. In fact, we played Donna Lee in unison together. And he's playing the...
Yeah. It was just an unbelievable... I don't even have a handful of photos of myself with celebrities, you know, because I just don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I met and befriended Harvey Phillips, and one of my prized possessions is my photo of me and Harvey Phillips holding my tuba.
That's awesome.
With Harvey Phillips, man. What a cool guy. And the greatest tuba player who ever lived.
I think so.
He really was. Anyway, back to your jazz arrangements. Were you playing out with jazz ensembles like that at gigs, or were you playing a kind of quintet, quartet kind of stuff?
No, during the college years, we actually, because the jazz ensemble wasn't actually part of the music to program at Fredonia State University, although they loved us because we drew a lot of high-quality students who wanted to play jazz and wanted to be part of the jazz ensemble, we did a tour every year on a bus, like Woody Herman's band would mm-hmm. do, went to all the way out to Long Island and back to Fredonia, which is, you know, upstate New York, as a sort of a recruiting tool for the school.
Mm-hmm.
And so we played concerts with that band all the time. And then when I left school, several of the members that were in the jazz ensemble moved to Buffalo, New York from Fredonia, which is only about 45 minutes away. And I played with my own 16-piece band. I made an album with my big band. And we played, at some points, we were playing five nights a week with a 16-piece band and getting paid in Buffalo, New York during the late 70s.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that was a time... And not you know, bringing out my musical electric wheelchair. Back in those days, you could have. But there were a lot of big bands out there playing.
Yes, there were.
And there were a lot of – I mean, I think maybe – well, because I was a young kid then, mm-hmm. but we were getting tickets to see all of those bands. And some – Stan Getz.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Stan Kenton, you mean?
No, I mean Stan Getz, the saxophone player.
Oh, I see.
You know who I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, who put together his own band.
Oh, wow.
Because that was the way – he was just a kind of a quintet player.
Right,
famous,
yeah, that's
for
why
kind
I was
of being
confused.
Having a messed up life and playing saxophone solos. But at that time, it was like, well, I got to – you know, I got to get like 10 guys
mm-hmm.
and do kind of a combo sort of jazz ensemble thing
mm-hmm.
because that's what was going on. I'm not – and, you know, Maynard Ferguson
yeah.
and all those kinds
Maynard's
of
– Maynard's band, Woody's band, Stan Kenton – those were the main ones that were touring during that period of time. And then there were the throwback bands like the Tommy Dorsey
Right. It's not the same band. It just occupies the same space right. as people die.
Yeah. It's kind of like the Platters where there were five of them.
Right, right. But that was – I don't think that goes on anymore.
No.
Or I don't see them – I don't see it anywhere.
No.
I mean, it's a very – it's almost a kind of an academic study – of jazz ensemble performance, but really you can't get out there and sell any tickets to it.
No.
you know, because you're just selling tickets to the high school band kids.
That's really what
we're coming. Well, that's who's Maynard Ferguson. Absolutely. I mean, Maynard Ferguson in Philadelphia, and we would go, and you knew every high school jazz ensemble in Eastern Pennsylvania was there just to watch guys on trumpets and trombones and everything just go absolutely crazy.
Which is amazing.
Which is amazing.
Right.
And Peter Erskine was there, an amazing drummer. Bob Militello, who right. we've talked about, mm-hmm. a woodwind player, mm-hmm. and a flute player, mm-hmm. who I think originated the humming in harmony with himself as he played the flute,
yeah,
which was showbiz shtick,
yeah.
but it was a lot of fun to watch.
Absolutely. I think it was a little bit of a throwback from Ian Anderson. From
Jethro Tull, from yeah, Jethro. I guess.
But he had his own.
But he had his own thing he was doing scales down as he was humming up and
trip.
Doing this weird thing, which was pretty cool.
It was amazing.
So what? So when did you come to California in order to take this composition into what it became mm-hmm. and what it's become, which is, you know, being. Very popular and writing and television shows and animated shows and doing all that kind of stuff. Was it computers?
Yes.
Did computers really kind of open that world?
Absolutely. I think I made a choice in the early 80s when MIDI was really becoming popular. I said, I got to learn this. I got to be into this because I know that this is going to be where the work is.
Because it was drying up for the arranger who just does part. I do parts for trombones, and then I need a band to come and pay me for the muse for the arrangement and be out there playing it. And
just for the mock-up purposes alone of being able to take a MIDI, take your orchestration and have a MIDI orchestra play that was just a great tool. And I used to call it because I started working on an Atari, and it had a notation program, so you could actually manipulate the notes that you were working on the staff like it was music paper.
On the screen itself. Did you have to do it while playing Pong or anything your Atari?
Really.
You had to kind of hit it just right to kind of send it into the musical staff.
Yeah, that was exciting for me to see that. You know, that I felt like, wow, I've really arrived to the 21st century.
You had the Atari that you could adjust on the screen.
Yeah, with floppy disks. This is great, you know.
Did you take to that computer program of music? Programming of music well? Did you take to that as quickly as you did in learning about notation?
I ate it up, and plus I had at that time a son who said...
Oh, so he was good at plugging the stuff in.
He was great. He would say, no, Dad, it's the same thing if you press Shift F, you know, which used to, you know, when you got it like a, you know, 7-year-old, 8-year-old kid telling you that. But I learned a lot from him, though. And we ended up working together as co-composers after he was in mm-hmm. his teens, because we wrote the music for Ned's Declassified School Survival
Right. So, together. I mean, when I met you, certainly you already had a studio mm-hmm. that was state of the art. But it seemed that every 2 weeks there was another machine with glowy lights coming into the studio.
Yeah, I definitely spent some money.
Yeah, and increasingly, I wouldn't understand the first thing about what the new glowy light machine was doing.
You're so funny.
And you would say, well, I have to unplug everything now.
Yeah.
Put the glowy lights X5000 in there and replug that into everything. And that, I can't explain it to you, Tom, but it makes everything more powerful.
Well, you know, that was just such a great time in my life, you know, working with you on your album. You know, that was such a thrill having you come over to my place and sing your, you know, we recorded your acoustic guitar, got your vocals, and then started doing all of what we were just talking about.
But I remember when I was first in town and I was writing songs and I was doing all that stuff, and I would hear about these new kinds of keyboards that were trying to use the computer in part. Mm-hmm. Hey, this keyboard, it actually plays a tape mm-hmm. of human beings singing that note.
That's right.
So you hit the key, and then literally a physical tape would run of a person going, ah, and then you hit the next key, ah, or whatever, pardon me.
Yeah, absolutely.
But from that to all of these like sound modeling programs that mm-hmm. you had.
Right.
Where you're going, well, Tom, we could use this as a, we could use the sound of a Steinway grand.
Mm-hmm.
We could use the Bösendorfer, mm-hmm. which has the, these computer programs would play, I guess, this actual sampled note of that piano playing that note with everything, with the little bit of shake mm-hmm. of the string of the grand piano that it would have. Ray, so, I mean, it just sounds exactly like it.
It sounds amazing. Well, Ray Kurzweil was really the front runner in that. And from what I understand is it actually started with him and Stevie Wonder on a different aspect of it, because Stevie Wonder wanted to be able to read books. And Ray Kurzweil developed a technology to scan printed material and have words be spoken as you scan. So he had to create a library of human spoken word, and that became his concept of sampling, so that when it saw that character, it said,
"Oh, it would say the
right." It would actually
cat.
Right, and so you can actually read sentences by scanning it off of the printed material. Well, he took that same technology and said, "Well, why don't I do that? If I press this note on the keyboard, and it's supposed to be C on the keyboard, I'm going to record that note." Just the same way as I did record someone saying the, and so when I press this key, it's going to be that C on the piano or C on the violin on the first string. And that basic technology, the Kurzweil K250 was the first big practical sampling keyboard that emulated those sounds. And from there, as memory increased, you know how we used to think in megabytes, now we think in terabytes.
Well,
know?
Right. And just the computer power to
exactly.
save something.
That's right.
You sing a version of the verse and mm-hmm. you stop.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would say, well, we have to save that. So right. you're saving that to the computer, and the computer's going all the way to now. Even that, to young people, would be a foreign concept. What do you mean saving?
Absolutely.
Because you just press save, and it just goes, boom, is it saved?
Right, exactly.
You know, you put an encyclopedia, whatever it is, mm-hmm. save, no problem.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So I'm just curious, and I don't mean to make trouble or be a Luddite, but computers certainly changed your approach to music and really changed your entire life and career.
Absolutely.
What are ways that computers have wrecked the system?
Okay, now you're going to get me. You're going to paint me here, aren't you?
No, I'm not. I'm not. I just like what, you know, what, in what ways?
Well, I think that what it's done is that, like anything else, there are people who can get a drum machine or a computer, and I certainly don't want to sound condescending, but there are people who don't have the basic real skills of being a musician and who have created, quote, music because they know how to run a computer. And I think that that's probably one of the downsides of it, without sounding...
I think everyone in the arts is like that now, though. You know, everyone would – most people would say, without sounding – ..
Yeah.
There's that issue of the incredible availability.
That's right.
Of every sound you want.
Right.
With, as musicians know, drummers putting out a DVD or whatever it is saying, you can have me drumming on your album.
That's exactly right.
If you buy this kit and you put it in your time, it's me drumming on your album.
Right. It's like, for example, for drums, if you're saying, it used to be you brought a drummer into an isolation booth, you mic'd up his kit, and he would play the track and you would record it. Then it became, they had samples, like we were just talking about, you hit a key and it hits a snare drum, hits a bass drum, boom,
right.
hits a hi-hat. So then you could have all those keys and you could go, boom, pa, boom, right? You can
right.
play that, and that would be a performance. Now they have actually guys playing that performance.
Right, so you say, I want that drum kit sound, and the guy just goes, boom, ka-dee, boom, boom.
Exactly. And you press one key, and it plays the groove, it plays everything.
Right.
And you can time stretch it, make it slow down, make it speed up. And
I remember early on, I was in the Guitar Center, and you know they have the drum room up top. You have to go up a staircase.
Right.
And so I'm looking at guitars, and we're hearing just this unbelievable drum kit playing. That sounded live.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, boy, it sounds like some guy's going just crazy up there. It sounds cool. And I go up, and it was so early on that there are a group of guys in shock standing around a computer and an electronic drum kit.
Right.
And with the speakers going and everything. And everyone was – it was like we were looking at the golden idol from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Everyone was just – their minds were being blown
mm-hmm.
by, wait, you can do this now?
Yeah, right.
And it really did change everything.
Yeah, and there's been big changes like that have come along, you know, every 6 months that revolutionized different ways in which we
– What's coming, do you think, being the – now you're a very technologically savvy musician and composer. I mean, what's coming?
I think we've kind of reached a point where it's just fine-tuning what we have, because the basics have all been covered. We can emulate all these instruments. We can record them really, really quickly. What it's come to is being able to manipulate recorded material that's already been recorded. For example, there's a program called Melodyne that where you can actually look at what they call blobs of the notes that someone has physically sang or played on an instrument, and you can just grab those notes and retune them or fix them, take the vibrato out of someone's voice, add vibrato to someone's voice, make a note longer than it was, keep the center of the tuning what it really was, but if they went a little bit flat towards the end, just fix that. And you can do that with any instrument and any sound now. So that's where it's come to as far as that is concerned.
That's pretty crazy.
It's pretty crazy because when you listen, and it's sort of set a standard too, especially in pop music, most of the music that you listen to on the radio has been manipulated in some way or another. So you really don't know if a person can actually really sing that good.
Most of the time they can't.
There's several artists out there who just sing marvelously and just sing great.
Well, that's a wonderful thing.
It is a wonderful thing.
But you can sing into a live microphone now.
Yes, you can.
And it can go through the system,
right,
and make you into a great singer.
It's true.
Live,
yeah. and that's what we're talking about, the speed of the computers to process that information in milliseconds to actually take the notes you're singing right now and actually spew them out into the speakers in tune.
Right, and the little foot pedal that the guy at the Starbucks uses to do a Crosby, Stills, and Nash song,
right,
and just hits the foot pedal, and suddenly his voice is in three-part harmony.
Right.
And click the foot pedal, and he goes back to the lead.
Right.
I mean, it's just crazy.
It's fun stuff, though.
It is fun.
I wish
I knew how to do it. Yeah. I would do it.
You don't need a time. You just sing by yourself and play your guitar, and you sound amazing.
Thanks, buddy. Let's go. But before I get into that composing thing, which does fascinate me, but you've played live for so many years.
Yes.
And you've played with everyone. Could you tell – give me a couple of – not gossipy, but good – you played with, Peggy Lee for years.
Yes.
With Chuck Mangione, with all these – with the who's who, really, of the music business, of musicians that are just unparalleled in their composition and their performing ability. I mean, how long did you work with Peggy Lee?
11 years.
11 years, and were you keep piano?
Piano, yeah.
Acoustic and how
piano.
Many – for people who don't know Peggy Lee was a sort of a, what do you say, a torch singer?
Yeah, or
a couple of her
sultry.
Hits that people, sultry kind of,
yeah.
Nightclub.
She was never a loud singer. She never sang really boisterous.
No, it was sort of almost whispery kind of, you know.
Very cool.
Yeah, what was one of her songs? I'm blanking.
Fever.
You give me fever.
There you go.
But you kiss me fever all through the night.
That's her.
Did you enjoy that kind of work?
Oh, I loved it. It was so special work. I learned so much from her. You know, she was like playing for music history because she carried so much with her because she had worked with everyone. She started off with Benny Goodman when she was 17 years old and played with all the greats, sang with Count Basie's orchestra, was part of the Rat Pack at one point with Frank Sinatra and Sammy and Bing. She's worked with everyone and had so much, a great wealth of musicality that was so great to be around. I feel like of anyone in the music business that I worked with. In fact, I just did an interview with James Gavin, who's writing her autobiography, and we talked about my time with her and what I had learned from her. It was amazing, and I actually had the opportunity to write a song with her, which was really special working with her.
And would she do that in the show?
Yeah, we did. We actually used the song every night for the last 5 or 6 years that I worked with her to close the show. So it's a beautiful ballad that we wrote together. But she was an amazing person, and I learned so much from her phrasing and her style. And accompanying behind her was such a joy because you just knew where to go, you know?
Because she was predictable?
No, because she just was such a natural, and it just felt so good all the time. It was just amazing. Her sense of musicality and phrasing, her time, where she put the notes, where she – the thing that was so cool about working with her is she loved to do stuff that was really slow. Like we would do really, really slow down grooves that would – you really – and that's
which is whole, the, I was going to say, hard. That's about the hardest thing,
yes,
you could do.
Is.
Not the fast song.
No.
It's keeping in rhythm with the song that's going – slowly.
Absolutely. We used to do Watch What Happens, an old
Watch What Happens.
But she would start, she would do like, it would be like, let someone start believing in you. And you're down there, baby.
Yeah.
And you got to get into it. You can't fake that. You got to be, and we. She had such a wonderful, I mean, we played with Grady Tate, one of the greatest jazz drummers of all time. Monty Budwig, God rest his soul, played bass. I mean, all these guys were John Chiodini, who one of my best friends, who actually got me on the gig with Peggy Lee.
Wonderful guitarist.
Wonderful, amazing guitar player. Played all on all of those records with Natalie Cole after that. And
played on my album. I'll have
and
you know.
Now you're talking.
Yeah.
I like this,
no,
man.
John,
you should be
John's
proud of what you did. Man, that album is amazing.
And John was unbelievable. John was unbelievable.
Yeah.
So people people listen to my podcast a lot because I try to talk to people who generally don't get heard but who are working in the entertainment industry. So, and I don't mean to – and you do many more things than this, and we'll get to that aspect of your life too. But from such a wide variety of musical talent that you've worked with and everything and recording things with various artists and singers and musicians, how do you make the leap – to going, you know, to making those boing flap for a cartoon? I mean, how do you get into making these both musical pieces, composition,
yes,
and also interstitial boing, guy gets hit with a hammer,
yeah,
musically, timpani hit, boing,
yeah.
How does that happen?
Well, I had a great teacher in that, you know, Guy Moon, who wrote all the music for Fairly Odd Parents and numerous cartoon shows for Nickelodeon, was the master at that. And this guy would sit down, look at the picture, and get at his piano. He was a marvelous piano player, and just play it. And then we would take that music and orchestrate it from there. And I learned from seeing how he took harmonies and different sonorities and different rhythmic patterns to go, and my son was really, really great at this, at being able to get the tempo of the scene, because it's such an art. I mean, a lot of cartoon shows don't use that style anymore. Some of them just have sort of a music track that's playing along that doesn't really, really empathize with what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But Guy had this way of, like, every movement and every nuance in what every character said had a musical sound or a phrase that made it lay right. It's an amazing gift. It's a really, and so I learned from a great deal from him because of that.
And that led you to
being able to do it myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what show or shows have you been working on lately?
Well, my son and I did all the music for a show called Ned's Declassified School Survival Guide on Nickelodeon. And that it was an interesting thing because even though that's a live action show, Scott Fellows, who also produced Big Time Rush and was the creator of that, wanted the music to be like a cartoon soundtrack. He loved it when, like, if Ned would turn his head, it'd be like, dun-dun-dun.
Oh, that, uh-huh.
They're like, burn.
Right,
you know,
right.
And the kids are running around the school. It's like, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun- we took that style and kind of, and a couple of other shows, I don't want to say we're the first who did that, but we've seen other shows kind of copy that same style since
then. In live action.
In live action.
Right. And which, that is you taking it, making, but also assigning it to instruments.
Yes.
Inside your computer, but in the same way,
yes.
Making an arrangement and saying we need French horns,
right.
And we need a tuba at the end, of course, going blap,
yeah.
Because that's what the tuba gets.
I'm sorry, Tom.
No, it's my own little pet peeve. It's
sure
fine.
We had one that went.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, that one worked great.
Like a rhino thing?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what we're called to do.
Yeah, there you go.
Just rhinos, elephants.
It's your legacy, Tom.
And splats.
Yeah, splats.
So you've been doing, are you continuing to do that? Or have you?
Not right now, I'm.
Uh-huh.
But fortunately, because Ned's was such a popular show, they're still playing it 4 or 5 times a day. And that's what has – those residual income from that is what's allowed me to segue into what I'm doing now.
Really?
Yes.
So you actually make more residual income than the actors who are on the show.
Exactly.
Wow, good to know. Yeah. That the guy writing –
there was a lot more to it than the –
Okay, you added French horns, you skipped a tuba and whatever.
All right.
And you do – you've done okay.
Point well taken, Tom.
You've done okay.
Yes.
So yes, from there you explain. Now, you have always – love the performing aspect of it,
yes.
And still have performed. Can I just, you know, in addition to everything, before we get to the modern Emilio's modern life, but you were the pianist,
yes,
on Frasier, weren't you? For like the live audience,
yeah,
because
Cheers.
Kelsey Grammer. And Cheers.
And
Cheers is what you did. Cheers.
We did Cheers for 11 years, and Frasier for another 10.
You in a combo or just you?
Yeah,
yourself?
It was. We had a group. We had a quintet.
So you did Cheers because I know like Kelsey Grammer likes to sing.
Absolutely.
And he's a jazz guy.
Oh yeah.
So Cheers would not have. Would they have a comedian and a combo?
Both shows did.
Both shows
did. Yeah, we did a thing. The warm-up guy would do a few jokes and he'd say, now we're going to have the band play a tune. And we'd even do an interaction with the audience where we got into a play in a game called Where Are You From? And so he would ask people out in the audience where they were from, and he would send us up a list. And we would try to play a song from whatever place they were from.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it was really, really fun.
Yeah, because people don't know who don't see a taping of a sitcom.
Right. They don't
especially
get to see
in
them.
A one camera like Cheers or like Frasier, there's a lot of time between the setups. And if a live audience is there, there's a lot of time. So they'll have many times a comedian doing a little shtick and
exactly.
talking about, to remind people of where we were in the story.
Exactly.
And then do some songs.
Yeah, we would do the songs, especially during set changes. If they had a big setup change, like you mentioned, we would play. We were kind of like a Letterman kind of style band. We played instrumentals of pop tunes from everything from R&B tunes to some jazz stuff.
What did Kelsey Grammer like to sing?
He's a jazz guy. So would he
come up and sing a standard with you or something?
You know, he would fool around with it but never finished a song because he was so involved in the show, you know.
Uh-huh.
But we had a lot of fun with that, though. And you know, we were doing the Where You're From thing. If we couldn't think of a song, like if someone was from like Sri Lanka or like
yeah.
a place that we just couldn't come up with a song, we always played the theme from Motel 6.
Oh, good.
Da, 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 da. Exactly.
Nice. So I'm sorry to have gone off because I just remembered that. And I thought that was a pretty
interesting
thing.
It was a lot
of
fun. It was great, man. And I got great gifts. I have radios, umbrellas, jackets with Frasier and Cheers. I got all
and they'll be on
house.
eBay next week.
And no, they will not.
No, they will not. Your Frasier umbrella stays close to your heart.
Are you interested?
Your Frasier umbrella? Just tell me. Give me the eBay link,
okay.
And I'll not bid on it. But so you've performed for your whole adult, well, since sixth grade.
Yeah,
since
much.
What was the band's name? The Staircase?
The Magical Staircase.
The Magical Staircase.
And then Summer Voyage.
And Summer Voyage. But your composition on these shows, mm-hmm. as you said, has afforded you the opportunity to study acting now.
Yes.
So this, not that we are not in the autumn of your years, but you know, you're also not 22. At a later stage of your life,
absolutely.
You said, I have wanted to do this and I'm going to pursue this.
I've wanted to do this all my life. Acting has been a passion for me. I loved it when I was younger. I actually tried to start my acting career when I was in my 20s, but because I was struggling as a musician and I was raising a family, I had gotten an agent, and then when auditions would come up and I'd say, well, I got a gig,
right.
I can't go. They lost patience with me, and I couldn't make both happen at the same time, just for economic reasons.
So when you finally decide to do it, what's the first step? I don't even know now. You decide, well, I'm going to study acting. Like, mm-hmm. did you talk to people or did you take a class?
Well, it was kind of funny how it happened because there's an acting studio right out like 45 seconds from my house in Woodland Hills that Sarah Wood, who's Evan Rachel Wood's mom, runs. It's right on Ventura Boulevard, and it's called Actors West. And so I went over there and I said, I'd like to study acting. And it was a scene study class. I got in it, and boy, from the first week, I said, oh boy, this is, I love this. I really like this.
The first week, what do you do? Do you bring a monologue the first week?
No, since they gave me a scene to learn, and I can't even remember what it was from. It was from some film, and I brought it back the next week. I was off book and just went for it, and we worked it. And I was nervous. I was like really nervous, you know, because this was all new to me, you know. But I loved it, and I got that feeling of what I wanted, and so I took the same philosophy as I did towards my music career. Is just like I studied hard, I watched, I listened, you know, and I'm doing the same thing as an actor now.
What are a couple things that you've learned about acting that you didn't that have surprised you?
Well, I don't know if it surprised me, but I definitely think that the more I grow as an individual, as a person, and I find the center of who I am and just being in the moment and being focused, it really affects my acting in a great way. You know, I think the more I understand about who I am, the more I can embody a character.
And what do you mean by that? Like by who you
just
are?
In my interpersonal relationships, you know, one of my acting teachers said to me, you know, acting isn't therapy, but it is therapeutic. And I've found that it's allowed me to search different parts about my personality and who I am, where I'm from. Things like I mentioned to you before about my childhood and you know, that rage, that angst that I experienced in and around me, the vulnerability that I felt as a child. And all of those things, I think you start to find where they are in you, and you can bring them out in a character, in a role. And I find that it really informs my work. Like you said, I've been around for a while. I'm not a kid, and I have a lot of life experiences that I can draw from. And the more I do that, the more the portrayal of the characters that I portray becomes, I think.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been studying acting now?
It's been this July is 3 years that okay. I've been deep involved in study. I uh-huh. take a lot of classes,
and you haven't taken a break. You've just been seen studies and various.
A lot of on-camera work, because I like to know that what I'm doing is actually reading. Because, you know, you don't have this because you're an amazing actor. But when you're learning, you say, well, I'm feeling this way and my face is doing this and it looks like this. But then you on an on-camera class, you go, well, you know, that wasn't really reading like I thought it was. And so you get to know, like, okay, I see where I have to be emotionally or physically or psychologically. Because as you know, the camera kind of reads your mind. And, you know, you really got to be in that place. And so I learn a lot from
that. And often
that.
On camera, people think that you have to make a face. And really, all you have to do is think it.
Exactly. That's why I say the camera reads your mind.
The camera just says, oh, we get it.
Yeah,
we get it. You don't have to make the face.
Yeah, absolutely.
We just get it if you just think it.
Mm-hmm. It's just so true. And all of those, a lot of those subtleties and that I've learned.
You've been working in a lot of student films.
Yes.
Haven't you?
Yes, I have. A lot of students and independent films. And then, fortunately, things have gone on to I have a lead role in an independent feature that's going to be coming out this fall.
And what's that called?
It's called Tourbillon.
Tourbillon.
It's spelled like Tourbillon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually the name comes from because the story involves a young girl who's been genetically modified to stay at the age of 23 years old. And Tourbillon was actually one of the first watch mechanisms that was invented in Sweden that kept really accurate time without winding it, because it used the gravity mm-hmm. of moving your wrist, and only lost 14 minutes throughout an entire year. So it's about the accuracy of time and what time means in our lives. A really brilliant story.
And who do you play in that?
I play a character named Victor Rocher, who's the guardian for? I'm kind of the red herring in the film, because the girl Daniela, who's been given genetic modification, is the only one in our 4-person family that has the pure version of the formula. And I'm aging slowly, slowly, slowly. I'm in my 50s, but I'm actually 100 and something, but aging slowly. And my job is to make sure that she stays alive until we can recreate the formula. The pure version of the formula that's in her, because her father, who originally created, was killed.
Mm. So. Now, I have to let you go. But a couple more questions, and I'll let you go, because I've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you. First of all, how can people find you on the web and places where they can see your acting?
Yes.
At Emilio Palame, E-M-I-L-I-O-P palame-actor.com.
Correct.
With a lot of your work.
Yes.
And as a musician that has played from Magical Staircase to Summer Voyage and on, what are a couple of your favorite songs?
Of all time?
Of all time. That just, you have just, you've played it, and you've played it at 60,000 weddings, and you've played it everywhere, but somehow there's something about it that you still love.
Geez, that's a funny question. I've never really thought about that. Just not necessarily to play, but one of my favorite songs of all time is In My Life by the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
I love that song. And then there's some R&B songs that I really like that go to a completely different, like September by Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Great song.
Great song. I really like that. There's some of the classic Jimi Hendrix songs that I really like. Oh, okay. What's the name of the tune by Cream? On a boat, on a river, and a raging sea. this is great. I wonder what you're gonna do. Strange brew.
Oh, yeah, strange
girl, brew. What's inside of you? That I like that. That was one of my favorite songs of all time. I love the guitar solo in that. Eric Clapton kills.
Uh-huh. Now, are you still playing out? I mean, do you still play, or do you have gigs, or what's happening with that?
I play with my own band. I have the Emilio Palame Band. I'll probably be playing a concert next month.
Does that have a website, or does people...
Yes, that's just EmilioPalame.com.
Oh, okay.
That's my
music. And that's your live gigs and everything.
Yeah, and I have a CD called Be Who You Are that you can get on iTunes and CD Baby. Be Who You Are, Emilio Palame Band. It's a 9-piece R&B jazz kind of band. It's all my original material. I have a copy of it here for you, Tom.
I look forward to hearing it.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Emilio. I appreciate it.
My pleasure,
Tom. I'm glad that you are being who you are.
I am.
You seem very comfortable with yourself.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Have you been comfortable with yourself lately?
Well,
are you cool with you?
I'm really
cool.
Are
you being who you are?
I really am. You know, this acting has really, really put me in a zone that I the best way to describe it is that I'm really enjoying the journey so much. And one of the things, people ask me, you know, Emilio, you've had a successful career as a musician. Why would you want to, you know, take your stab at acting and go into acting? And I just say, well, apparently there wasn't enough rejection being a musician.
Exactly. Exactly. Hey, welcome. Welcome to the ice hockey game.
Yeah, really.
Put in a mouth guard, and I'm going to check you up against the glass.
Go Sabres.
Yeah. Buffalo Sabres. Not nearly the team that the Philadelphia Flyers are.
Oh, here we go.
Only the Lord saves more than Bernie Parent. Anyway, hey, thanks, Emilio.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks to Emilio Palame very much. Check out his website. Check out his music. He's fantastic. And thank you for listening to the podcast. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody at Nerdist Industries. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for helping me out on the live show. I'm all over this great land of ours. So check me out live if you care to. If you want to write, hey, info@TomWilsonUSA.com. Or you can write me a postcard, which many people do. P.O. Box 18106. Encino, E-N-C-I-N-O, California, USA 91416. And we'll talk to you next time. Thanks.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.